You do, of course, realize that prayer is one of the most useless, if not the most useless activity that most people might imagine. You realize that, don't you? You realize that prayer is mostly useless, at least in terms of what most people imagine as useful. Now, when I heard our retreat leader say this, I put down my pen and I looked up at our retreat leader. And what I was looking at was a 60-ish disheveled monk with a beard, Birkenstocks, not wearing socks, and a lot of crumbs from breakfast still on his black cassock. Looked like he just rolled out of bed. Abbot Andrew from St. Gregory's Abbey in Three Rivers, Michigan. And he saw me looking at him, and he said with a little smile, looking right back at me, "Good prayer is mostly useless." That may be how you know you're praying. You're beginning to feel useless. Now, this was coming from a monk, someone who gets up at midnight and again at 4 a.m., not to mention the 7 other times during the day, to say prayers, to read the Bible, to reorient his internal compass heavenward. And additionally, this was a monk who had read, traveled widely, who had worked in the world before becoming a monk, a man who had written books. He was not born in the ivory tower. He was something of an authority. And for Abbot Andrew to intimate that prayer is a useless activity would be like him saying that his own life was useless. He was trying to get our attention. He was trying to gently pierce our assumptions. On that silent retreat during Lent, Brother Andrew was trying to help us draw closer to God in prayer by identifying those places in our hearts and minds where we are tempted to fashion a relationship with God after the imagination of our own hearts. Those places where we're tempted to create a deity in our own image, you might say, rather than to move into the deeper holiness, the deeper powerlessness of the living God. And so this good monk was having us face that truth, that authentic and deep prayer before God never gives us the promise of achieving our goals. Lest those goals first be laid down before the feet of the kind of life that Jesus is actually calling us to live. You see, in comparison to the efficiency, in comparison to the expectations, in comparison to the certainty with which many of us go about accomplishing what we desire to have or to do in the world, there's a kind of deeper prayer and deeper experience of God that will not operate according to our certainty, will not operate according to our greatest efforts to have things our own way. As a tool in the toolbox of personal achievement, as lived out in the world's arenas, time spent with God does not have the effectiveness or the efficiency, let's say, of a pedigreed education. Doesn't have the effectiveness of physical beauty, charm, charisma, political savvy, social capital. And this kindly monk was simply reminding us that it is very hard to have a living relationship with God if we are actually very intent on serving two masters. Everyone at the retreat was a minister, a preacher, or a priest. All the clergy at this retreat knew that Abbot Andrew was simply closing all of the fire escapes, because we knew exactly what he was talking about. It's a kind of game that religious professionals play, of trying to have their cake and eat it too. One of the double binds, you might not be aware of it, but one of the double binds that most ministers, preachers, and priests find themselves facing at some point is the temptation of taking every interior experience of intimacy with God and seeking to mine from it some nugget of gold that might be sold out in the marketplace. There can be a temptation of taking the consolations, the gifts given in the deepest recesses of the inner temple of the heart, ostensibly consecrated to God, and then taking those and trotting them down to the marketplace of ideas, perhaps putting our signature beneath it, so that we might exchange them for some other form of currency. The currency of money, perhaps, the currency of social capital, the currency of some power and influence that is ultimately self-serving. Without appropriately examining our motives, without appropriate caution, this sleight of hand can result in the cultivation of a personal following. Perhaps creating a sort of cult of personality. Perhaps the religious professional becomes a kind of guru. A guru. Anything that be the shepherd of someone else's flock, namely God's flock. I've noticed this temptation is not unique to clergy. This temptation is faced by anyone who is ostensibly about the task of serving others as a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, a business professional, even serving others as a mother or a father or a spouse, who makes a gentle shift in their heart and mind so that in the end, the desire is to be served rather than to serve. In the times and places where ostensibly we are telling ourselves and others that we are giving ourselves away for the glory of God, we end up expecting others to give something of themselves to us. They must decrease, and we must increase. It's an example of that old problem that each of us faces. Doing all the right things, but very often doing the right things for the wrong reasons. And so after his baptism at the hand of John the Baptist, Jesus goes out into the wilderness to face the source of his own motivations. Jesus goes to the wilderness to face this very question of doing right things, but maybe for the wrong reasons. And there in the wilderness, Jesus meets the one who will become something of a constant companion throughout his ministry. There Jesus meets Satan. That's the one we mention at every baptism on page 306 of the Book of Common Prayer. There's a mistaken notion in popular Christianity that in our tradition, we don't recognize the personification of evil. But we ask people, do you renounce Satan and all the spiritual forces of wickedness that rebel against God? It's a proper name in our book with a capital S. Notice that each invitation Satan offers Jesus invites Jesus to whet the edge of his prayer and his intimacy with God with the purpose of getting something as a result of having a relationship with God. Each invitation is the same. Compromise God's means in order to achieve a desirable end. Get your religion working for you to gain something for yourself. The Catholic priest and writer Henry Nouwen summarized these invitations. It's the invitation or the desire to become relevant. It's the invitation to become spectacular. It's the invitation to become powerful. And so Satan whispers to Jesus, "Jesus, you need bread. The people need bread. So get some bread. Feed yourself. Feed the people. Jesus, do something useful with your prayers, something relevant. Don't be useless living beneath some religious precept. Jesus, you're alone and vulnerable. You could have power and influence over others. You have a special, a unique relationship with God. So do something useful. Do something spectacular, like jumping out into space. Do the fantastic thing, Jesus. Entertain them. Capture their imaginations, and they will love you and they will adore you. Jesus, you are a king without a kingdom. Just glance in my direction, Jesus. Just shake my hand. Shake my hand, Jesus. And you can have not one kingdom, but all the kingdoms. You see, Jesus, do something useful. Become powerful. Become a Caesar for God's kingdom. It's the same invitation. Just turn a little corner in your mind, and you can have anything. Be anyone. Make your relationship with God something useful, something that can get things done, something relevant, spectacular, and powerful. And so this is often how the worm can turn in our own hearts, in our own minds. It can be a hard teaching, because anyone who has spent even one moment in the tangled secret webs of the motivations that lie deep within the human heart and mind, they know that in this moment Jesus is a champion. Jesus is a champion because Jesus does not seek to be relevant, spectacular, or powerful in order to achieve personal gain. God never promises us that we will not face the greatest temptation and losses in the midst of this life. I do not hear Scripture telling us that we will not be tempted. Rather, I hear Scripture telling us that when we do face this wilderness of our own motivations, when we face our own choices, perhaps about making God useful or getting our religion to work for us, that we don't face that alone. You see, when we would turn that corner in our minds, when we would just glance in His direction, the capital S on page 306, when we would just glance in Satan's direction and away from God, the promise is from Scripture that we don't stand out there alone. Jesus stands in that wilderness with us. Jesus stands in that wilderness as we glance in that direction, because He's already lived in that wilderness. And Jesus shows us that there is a deeper wisdom that rests on the other side of the moment of temptation. There is something in this life, there's something in this life we're living beyond being relevant, spectacular, and powerful. And that something is the wisdom of becoming one of God's holy fools. To become foolish for God. To be like Jesus. To become a useless vessel in the eyes of the world. So that He might become useful to God. And thereby become of ultimate use to us. You see, Jesus will not turn stones into bread for a day. He won't turn stones into bread for a day. So that He might ultimately become the bread. So that He might become the bread that lives beyond all mortal days. There's a deeper wisdom. Jesus becomes a bread that feeds us body and soul, not just daily, but until we go and feast with Him. Where we feast with Him in the place that there is no temptation. No. There is only joy. Only joy, and that is everlasting.